Hey everyone, before this episode starts, I just wanted to say thank you for listening, as always, and I want to apologize for this upcoming audio. It's a bit rough, but I think the conversation is good, still fun. We have a new setup, and for some reason it didn't record with my mic. Instead, it recorded with my computer built-in mic, which needless to say is not the best, so bear with us, but hopefully you enjoy this, and let's jump into it. Welcome to the At Leisure Podcast. This is a show about sports, video games, movies, and just basically the things we do with our leisure time. And today it is Dune time. I can't wait to talk about this movie. But let's introduce the guests first. So before we just jump into it, we have one of our mainstays in Spencer. Glad to have you back, dude.
What's up? Glad to be here.
And then next we have the long-awaited return guest in Will, who is returning from all the way back in episode 2. Congrats on all the life accomplishments, you know, since then.
Thank you. Thank you. I've been asked back every week and I just wasn't able, you know.
Just turn it down. I know. You've got like a wait list, and I finally made it. So, and then our newest guest, Gabe, who I've finally gotten on the podcast after much persuasion. Super pumped to have you, dude.
The one and only?
The firefighter. So, you know, we have our first hero on the podcast, so that's awesome. Well, before we dive into it also, I just want to say that we've got our – well, I'll have all the timestamps below as usual, and we'll go non-spoilers first. We'll try to keep it more vague than not, and then we'll just jump into spoilers. We won't spend too much time on the non-spoilers, but that way we kind of cover our bases there. So I guess, when do you start us? How do we feel about Dune?
All right. Well, I mean, it's a pretty perfect movie. That's all we got to say. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe. go see it.
Yeah, I don't know. That's going to be a struggle to do a non-spoiler. Yeah. This is a movie, like, this is worth not getting spoiled. So I'll try my best to not say anything that'll give anything away, but it's you have to see it in theaters too. Like,
no, it's, yeah, it's definitely a must see in theaters. Like, the acting, the score, the story, all of it. I don't really have a complaint. I'll try and think of one just to make it a little more exciting, but as of right now, I don't have one.
Well, I always say, like, when we do a podcast for this, it's normally going to be over movies we like, so, you know, maybe we don't have any complaints. I mean, this is one movie I walked out and thought, was that the best movie I've ever seen? You know, like, that doesn't happen very often, but yeah, straight up, I am going to have to really sit on this.
Yeah, there was, so, I don't know, how familiar is the audience with our rating system?
We go 0 to 10, but also I've had guests on that don't do that, so it's whatever your rating system is.
Well, there's a lot of wrong people in the world, but the 1 to 10, y'all, so for people who don't know, I'm just going to explain everything real quick. Exactly how I explained it to people who ask me what my hobbies are, and I'm like, I rate movies. Like, it's the only thing I do nowadays other than play with my family. So I do 1 to 10, 10 being the impossible, 9s being the best of the best, the Babe Ruth of the movie game. 8s are the greats, but there's not that, like, amazing plot that just blows you out of the water or anything like that. It's just all around great execution, great movie. 7s is your standard. Most movies that you see in theater that you enjoy, but you're not going to go buy another movie ticket for, just good movies. Everything under that is basically the stuff that you said that you don't put on the podcast, just because you do typically the movies that we like. So with that said, Brett has continuously called me a Grinch of movie reviews and even made a pie chart showing how many of my movies don't end up in the 8s or 9s and almost always in the 7s and a whole
it's embarrassing.
Lot of 6s. It's called being a movie critic, not a movie.
You watch you torture yourself all the time.
No, it's not true. And here's the deal. If we continue to give these movies 7s, 8s, 9s when they don't deserve it, then you're going to continuously get the crap that Marvel puts out that's not that good, but people will go spend the money on it. So you got to rate these movies hard. It's just like, you know, I'm about to have a daughter. I'm going to tell her standards had to be high. Otherwise, people will lower the way they behave for you to meet that low standard, okay? So anyways, let's get back to the movies. I only have, I mean, probably less than 6 movies in the 9s. None of them are That's over crazy. A 9.4, and that includes movies like Interstellar, The Dark Knight, Fury, Django Unchained. And this movie, with no spoilers, all I can say is it's a 9.8. And it made me regret all the times in entertainment history that I have used the word epic to describe something because I'm like, that should have been reserved for the likes of this movie. It freaking blew me away. It was like every scene felt so freaking grand. And I, like you said, you came out and you were asking yourself, you know, is that the best movie I've ever watched? Literally, I'll just say, and this is not a spoiler, but obviously there's battle scenes. I'll say towards one of the ending battle scenes, when people start, you know, revealing themselves out of a certain type of land, I'll say, I literally had to, I wanted to stand up. I wanted to squeal. And I remember I looked at Spencer, I looked at Will, I looked back at the screen, and the thought came into my head, is there such thing as a perfect movie? Because I literally, I might be watching it. I'm not really sure. And I gave it a 9.8 literally only because I wanted to go 9.9 on this movie, but there's a Dune 3 in the works right now. And I was like, I have to save whatever space I can just in case he reaches a new height, which if he does, it's going to be like Brett, whenever me and you went to Texas Day Brazil for the first time in high school, and we skipped prom. And I remember towards the end of our meal, I saw that you had this really sad look on your face, and I was like, what's wrong with you? Like, we just had one of the best meals of our entire life. We're 18 years old, and we're eating at an unlimited steakhouse. Like, life doesn't get any better. We got our babes on our right arm, great steak in our mouth. It's like a perfect world right now. And I remember you said, it's sad thinking that I have to go back home and eat regular people food again for the rest of my life. That's what Dune 3 is going to do to me with movies. If it beats Dune 2, every time I go to a movie, I'm going to have to deal with the thought of, it's not as great as the Dunes. And that's how freaking good these movies are. And other than that last point, the beginning of the movie threw me. I was like, this is weird. Like, I'm not sure if I'm this level of nerd to get weird like this. But man, as it progressed, the weirder it was, the more I loved it. As I'm all about this.
It leans into the weird perfect.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's better than the book. Like, I know that might be sacrilege to people who've read the book, but literally this takes creative liberties. Like, rarely do I think, oh, the source material is worse than the remake, but like, he makes decisions. The pacing in this movie is so much better than the book, in my opinion. There's just a lot of decisions that he makes. And yeah, it leans into the weird, but it doesn't do it in a way that is off-putting to an audience, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm reading the book after watching the movie, because I feel like I'm getting to re-experience Denis Villeneuve's scenes, but with more context. So the book to me is beautiful. But like Spencer, I know you watch Mike's book reviews on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I watch his reviews. It's his all-time favorite book. And but he talks about how like a lot of people they either love it, but most of the time they're just like, it's a pretty average book. But if you really enjoy the movies and then you go into the book, it's just like getting every single scene, but with more detail. And it makes the book awesome. So I'm enjoying the book right now, but I'm only a few hours into it.
It definitely varies from it too. Like I love that he keeps the themes though. Like he doesn't, it's not like a contradiction of the book. It like still builds on the themes, but in a new, different way. Yeah. How do you say his name? Because I think, is it not Denis Villeneuve?
Yeah, I think so. It's like French.
Yeah, it's Denis Villeneuve.
He's from Montreal or something.
It's so hard to say.
The Mexican in me wants to say Denis Villeneuve. It sounds Hispanic. Yeah. It looks Hispanic.
Yeah.
So I read it as Hispanic, but you're right. He's Canadian or whatever.
Yeah, he's like French Canadian.
Yeah, that's why it's a fancy boy name.
Yeah, that's how you spell it and that's how you pronounce it. That can't be. We're talking about two different directors.
Say it again.
Denis Villeneuve. Yeah.
Okay, see, that's the thing is I don't know either. Like, that's why I'm asking y'all because I'm like, I'm just a country bumpkin out here trying to say this guy's fancy name and I can't do it. I keep saying it different ways all the time. So,
If he keeps making movies this good, it's pronounced Daddy and I'll call him that.
I know. I'm like, I just want to put the respect on his name and I just can't do it because I can't say it.
Going back to the ratings thing that you had, Gabe. Yeah. I'm the opposite. I'm pretty liberal with my rating score. Like, I have movies that are a 1, and I have movies that are in the 9s. I have, like, 15, 20 movies that are in the 9s.
That's because you enjoy movies. That's normal.
Yeah, I really enjoy movies. So, like, if I'm feeling it in the theater, it's going to get a high score, but it also has to hit and a lot of other aspects too. It's like just a good feeling movie isn't going to do it. But just like Gabe said, this movie, I'm going to have to move every single movie down at least one point is how I feel like I have to do now, just to give it the respect that I felt in the theater. Cause just everything is a 9.9.9. Like, it's crazy. I can't describe how much better it is than any other movie I've ever watched. And I know it sounds so dramatic. It's like, it's ridiculous, right. But
it sounds crazy, but it's not. And I don't think you can really understand it until you've seen the movie, obviously. Cause like, to me, first of all, I rated it a 9.5 originally. And I was like, but let me sleep on it because that feels kind of high. It's a little, you know. But then, like, the longer I thought about it, I was like, I can't afford to move this down. It's not going to drop below La La Land, which is high up there for me. La La Land. I threw that one out there just for the laughs. But La La Land, Joker, Infinity War. I mean, La La Land is in my nines. But I kept thinking, like, there's no way it's going to remain. Number one for me was Shawshank Redemption. It is Shawshank Redemption.
It's great.
But I was like, I have to give it time. And then this morning I woke up and I was like, I can't do this. I'm just holding it back.
Yeah.
So it's now tied. The
closest thing to it is, to me, was The Dark Knight, because I was a lover of Batman, so it's a little unfair. And that's what's crazy about Dune is I didn't know, care, or think about Dune ever until it came out. Batman, I grew up with a Batman figure in my hand since I was freaking 3 years old. And I remember watching The Dark Knight, and every single scene that went by, I'm like, that's an A-plus scene. That's an A-plus scene. That's an A-plus scene. But when I watch Dune, it's like, if that's A-plus, then this is, you know, that S-tier, that A++. Like, it just felt, every single scene felt so big. Especially us going to see it in IMAX.
Beautiful, I mean, too.
Money well spent.
Looks like a poster all the time. You can just take a frame, put it on your wall.
The only way I thought this could be better was if, like, I asked Spencer. I was like, imagine seeing this in that Las Vegas sphere. Like, if you could just completely... I mean, that I would pay a couple to several hundred dollars worth of money to have a ticket to watch Dune. You know, formatted to that screen, because
we have one of those in Fort Worth.
Right now.
Yeah, it's been around for like 20 years or something.
Like no, that. That's not like the sphere though. I mean,
no, it's not. It's crazy. Not that big or not that quality, but it's one of those big dome ones that is like into peripheral vision and everything, and it's like super clear and high quality.
Okay, well, if they show Dune in that, then I will probably try to spend money on that.
Yeah, last time I checked, it was under construction, but like they're redoing it, remodeling it to make it nicer and newer because it was old at that point. But I'm hoping they do it. That'd be sick.
The only thing at that theater was a bunch of bugs, and like real life bugs. It wasn't even a bug's life or nothing good. It was like centipedes running around and stuff.
High praise for whatever cinema that is. Gabe, I want to point go back to something you said though. Like you never thought about Dune before.
Yeah.
I think watching this, there's just so much clear influence on sci-fi that Dune had that I don't think people thought about before. And I think this movie, like these, what is happening here is like putting this franchise in its right place is like, hey, this is one of the best works of all time. And people don't think about it because it was never made into a good movie. Now it is. And it's like, you can see all the influences it had on Star Wars. You can see all the influences it had on The Matrix. You can see all the influences it had on, I don't know, shoot, even some like Game of Thrones. Like there's just so much here that other people have borrowed from, and I think it's cool to just go back to like the original. Like this guy thought of these things a long time ago and is like changed the trajectory of entertainment, and no one thought about it until now.
What I've kind of picked up on that note, like through social media and just listening to different channels talk about it, it's like kind of what Lord of the Rings did. Like, you know, Tolkien came in and basically godfathered the fantasy genre with Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also popularized the fantasy world through cinema with its, you know, original trilogy. And it seems like with Dune, it was from, well, I could be wrong, but it seems like Frank Herbert kind of godfathered, you know, the sci-fi world, but Star Wars took it and popularized the sci-fi world. And so Dune kind of got left in the dust as far as, you know, being at the forefront of people's mind when they think about sci-fi.
And it's different, too, because Star Wars is, like, more high fantasy than it is high sci-fi. Like, I'd say, like, The Odyssey. I'm trying to think of some other like sci-fi. There's been more sci-fi movies that have been more sci-fi than Star Wars, but haven't reached the mainstream like appeal of Star Wars. So I don't know. I think it's just cool. It's got its rightful place in pop culture now. And
yeah,
I don't know.
Do y'all think this movie, like everyone that watches this movie will like it? Or do you think there's certain people that will think it's boring?
No. Because yeah, no.
The first Dune, I know a lot of people like, so... like it and give it a low rating.
There's a lot of stupid people in this world.
It's just so hard sci-fi. Like people get bored. I don't know. This is not like an average, like eat popcorn, enjoy like an explosion. Right. Like you got to pay attention. Yeah. And it's long and it's weird. And so like, I totally understand. I appreciate people giving it a shot, you know, but it feels like this movie is made for me specifically. Like if you gave me money and said, hey, make a movie that I'm going to enjoy 100%, it's going to be something like this, something weird, something off the wall, something epic in scale. And it's weird too, because there's like, who's the good guys, who's the bad guys, what's really like the messaging here. And like, you can kind of get it at the end. It's like, I don't want to spoil it, but it's just, it's very interesting in the sense of like, not black and white, you know. And like Star Wars, I always knew who the good guys were, who the bad guys were. And I'm not saying that's bad, but I'm just saying you have to pay attention. And I think that's
the target audience is definitely older than like something like Star Wars would be. So they're assuming the audience is paying attention and actually like focusing on like trying to pick apart everything versus it telling you everything, like it's showing it to you and you got to kind of put it together.
And I think that makes rewatches more fun too, because then it's like, all right, you're always picking up some new kind of subtle things that are happening. Yeah.
But like, I would not, like I could not have gotten up in the theater to go pee and come back and not miss something.
Yeah.
If I ever had to go, it would have been the first time I would have tried to pee in my cup. No question.
I had to pee the last like hour and a half of that movie.
I can't tell you
for certain. I told Spencer that, you know, when we went to the restroom together after the movie. But during the movie, I can't say for sure how long. It was a long time, though, because I was hurting by the end of the movie. But I was so afraid to look down at my watch, Brett, because I was like, I don't want to know that I only have 45 minutes left to enjoy this, or an hour 15. I was like, whatever it is, I saw Spencer check his watch. I was like, oh, I want to know, but I don't want to know, because I just want it to keep going. And so talking on your time note, I was surprised, you know, when Josh watched it for us and then he said that he actually wished that it was longer. I don't know what his taste of movie is, like as far as like if he likes sci-fi or not.
For Dune 1.
But but that surprised me, saying that he wanted more. I want more too, but for the fact that I just absolutely loved it. I hope that there's director cuts that'll come out that are 3+ hours or whatever. But Dennis or Danu or Daddy, whatever you want to call him, he talked about how the general audience today is more willing to buy a ticket. He said something about how audiences now appreciate buying a ticket, knowing that they're going to get 3 hours of entertainment, versus several years back when you buy a movie for the same dollar amount, but you're only getting an hour and a half to 2 hours. So they're talking about how Dune, the next Dune Messiah, is going to be 3+ hours long. And I'm like, please.
Give it to us. But again, that's not for everyone either, because I know people always complain about how long movies are. And I'm like, especially if it's a good movie, I don't care.
I agree, though. I feel like that complaint is, I think it's going away. I think part of that might just be because people who don't love sitting in movie theaters now have more access to do those things through streaming at home. So they're just not complaining. And
that's true.
So for the people who do love movies, you know, they're continuing to go out and support, which everyone should do. For a movie like this, buy tickets, show up, create box office revenue, and let it happen. Because movies like this need to keep coming.
All right. Anything else before we jump into spoiler talk? I think the music's good in this. Music's great. I think it's better than the first one.
Yeah, I actually, 100%. I can't even remember the music, if I'm being honest. I was so sucked in. I wasn't hearing it. I was feeling it.
I thought it was masterful too when they didn't play music.
Yeah, but the opening sequence, that's the first thing you notice. Like this is a completely different type of movie. But I felt during that opening sequence, because of the music, the same way I felt in the opening of The Greatest Showman.
Oh, like, gosh.
It just started. And I was like,
We need a separate podcast to just talk about our movie list, because y'all are killing me.
We have a lot. But like, I obviously know it's completely different.
for the movie lovers out there, Will's compared this movie to two musicals already. Please no. It's better than that. Okay, go ahead.
It is a significantly better movie than both of those musicals I've mentioned. However, like just that initial like, oh wow, this is like, Gabe, I saw that movie with you and you were smiling just as big.
That movie's great, but I'm not going to mention it in the same breath as Dune 2.
That's a good point. You make a good point. But anyways, so just the, like, it's shocking to me that you didn't even notice the music, Spencer, because I was like,
yeah, it was good.
It's not that I noticed it like in a bad way. I was just feeling, I was so absorbed in the movie that I was just, I don't know. I was like out of body experience or something. The first Dune movie, I didn't like that little girl singing with her, you know, whatever this song is. I didn't like that in the first Dune movie, and I noticed it. This whole second movie, if they did it, I didn't even know because I was so.
I noticed it. And I
love that sound. It started off with that like guttural like roll roll, and then it cut to I was like, oh, this is about to go hard in the paint.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
You want to jump into spoilers?
Well, just a quick note. It wasn't the music that really blew me away as much as the just like scene by scene sound effects that they were putting into the movie. Like Spencer recognized on one of the major fight scenes how every blow of the fight just was, it sounded like a punch on your own body because it was so like exact and just in the IMAX theater, especially so loud. But I can also think of one scene. You know what? You should probably go spoilers.
All right, let's go spoilers. Hey, warning, spoilers. All right, we're going into it.
Oh, so now we're in spoilers, and I'm still talking about music, right? So the scene with Timothy Chalamet, when he gets on the worm, and you hear the storm happening around him and the sand, like, hitting his face and body and – I mean, it sounds like it's coming through the freaking screen, and my sand is just going by your head. You feel like you're in the middle of a storm, and you're embraced. And again, I'm going to use this word, this epic moment with the protagonist of the movie. It's just like, holy cow, I can't imagine this feeling any more real than what it does right now.
That scene is so good, dude. I was in the theater. I went and watched with Jeff. I wish we could have him on because, you guys watched it together. I wanted Jeff on here too, but Jeff was like, we looked at each other and we were like, is this really happening? And like the sound it made, it sounded exactly like you, almost like water. God, it was so good. It was so good. Oh, it's better than my imagination. That's why it's better than the book.
Yeah, I think what Gabe was saying about the fight at the end, they like cut the music out. So the only thing you did hear, because there's no speaking, like them making contact with each other, that probably is the craziest fight scene of all time. And I think it even beats out like Star Wars fight scenes in Episode 1 and Episode 3. Like those are my two favorite like fight scenes of all time, you know, for nostalgic reasons and just good choreography and stuff. But that Dune fight scene was next level.
Yeah. If you're listening to the podcast, you know, I'm still holding those Star Wars fights better than that, but it was really good. It was really good.
Well, I think a good fight scene that's really like comparable is the confrontation in Les Mis, and not, no, I'm totally kidding.
I was about to cut your feed, actually.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. I just was like, how can I throw another musical in here now that I've done it twice? No, but you're absolutely right. Like every single one of those like guttural punches, it's like you hear, you feel it. It was incredible. And it's shocking because it's not like, you know, Anakin and Obi-Wan flipping through the air and lightsabers, and it's not as cool,
elegant, yes,
but like it feels more like rugged and real.
I liked how they cut the music out for that, but also at the very beginning of the movie too, when the Harkonnens are going after Paul and his mom and the whole Fremen tribe that they were with, and the Fremen are like sneak attacking them and dropping them off that mountain, and Paul, and it's just the bodies are hitting the floor just dead silent, and it's just bah, bah.
The first couple scenes, I forgot how like immediate at the beginning it is, but when they're like floating up the mountain and it's like a real like panoramic view, as soon as I saw that, I was like, this is gonna be the best movie of all time. That was like my first thought, was like, this is it.
Turn the gravity off or whatever and then turn it back on, or however their suits were. It was cool.
I will say, for me, I was like, is this cool? I think this is cool, but it also looks pretty fake. It kind of has that Princess Leia look to it, where they're real floaty.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There's a part of me that's like, There must be some imaginary cable that's pulling them.
It looked like that to me too.
But cool. The way when it wrapped up, like you said, I was like, oh no, that's perfect. That felt perfect.
Yeah.
I also liked how it was like Paul and his mom still trying to figure out how to fight within the Fremen because they're doing their own thing and they're just trying to survive, you know? Mm-hmm. And then they steal the water from them while they're live.
Yeah, that's really that live water suction. I was like, what does that even feel like? It's like most of the time you see someone get stabbed, you're like, that would hurt. But I watched somebody get the water sucked out of his body. I'm like, what? It's the opposite of drowning, I guess.
Give it blood, but just a lot of it?
Dehydration?
Yeah. That must be it. Rapid side effects of dehydration. That's it. Heat stroke, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, no. It's brutal, though. And they're like, it's dirty water, but we still use it.
Like, yeah. Yeah. I love that. They do such a good job of showing the necessity of water and everything. Like, even when it's not being told directly to your face, like they do such small things to make you constantly like live in the realization that they're in a harsh world, no matter what the scene is. And that's what's so beautiful about the directing is he really brings the whole world into an understanding of, you know, what they're going through. It's so good.
All right, we can just kind of go from there, too. They go into the Sietch with the Fremen, and immediately Stilgar is kind of on the side of, oh, okay, this guy might be the chosen one. What do they call him? Paul has so many names. He's a man of many names. They originally, who's the, is it Moadib? Is that the Fremen's word for the savior?
Moadib is the mouse of the desert.
That's what he picks. What did they call him?
They call him something like the Al Shaddab or something like that. I know that the Bene Gesserit calls him the Kizak.
Kizak. Haderach.
Yeah, something Haderach, like Meshach. That. Yeah, Meshach, Bendigo, something. But I think it's the El. I think El Shahad is the worm or something like that. Paul is the Ayi Shalub. I don't know what it is, whatever word it is. Dennis, whatever his name is. You know what? I can't say Daddy too many times, so I'm just going to say the director of this movie. You know, he had an entire language created for the Fremen for this movie. Did you know that?
Yeah, that's absolutely insane.
No, I didn't know
that. I believe it. It sounded real.
Yeah, he had it created for Dune 1 and then carried it into Dune 2. And just speaking of Stilgar, he's one of my all-time favorite, like, comedic relief characters, because usually, like, you know, someone will be designated for that comedic relief role, like even in a fantastic movie like Get Out, you know, that guy that comes in, the cop that is comedic relief. But sometimes it's like, especially in Marvel, the jokes come off and it's like, that was a good joke, but also it took away the seriousness of a really great moment. His comedic relief never interrupted the drive that you were watching on screen. Like it lightened the atmosphere and everything, but it kept you on pace with how serious the movie was being.
Right. He didn't say they weren't jokes.
Like
he was stating something and it was only funny to the audience. It wasn't really funny to anyone in the movie.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Like whenever he's out there, he's like, this is the day you become Fremen or the day that you die. Basically, when he's about to ride that worm.
Yeah,
he's like an important figure. He's not some just throwaway character that's in there just for the jokes, like you were saying. He's a religious extremist.
Yes.
So when he says extreme things and he just sounds kooky, you laugh at it. But in the world, he's...
Like when he said, as it is written, he 100% meant it. Like it was not... But it was hilarious when he said it.
Have you seen all the...
He's so humble.
Have you seen? Yes, that I love that part.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He says he's not out of humility. It means that he is. Like, of course. Yeah. Have you seen all the memes surrounding this guy? Like, it shows Paul Atreides holding up the calculator that has like boobies written on it. And then he's like, as it's written, like, shows his face, like, getting excited. Like, he did that trick on a calculator, so he must be the chosen one. And just Paul Atreides farts. As it is written, like,
oh my god,
the memes are hundreds by the hundreds, and they're so funny. I love them.
That's good.
Yeah, he is a standout.
Yeah, yes,
right.
What it's weird too, because So I haven't read the books. I don't know. But it seems like they artificially planned this Messiah figure, right? But by the end of it, it almost seems like he is a legit, like, prophesied character that becomes, like, more than just a scripted character that they want to have powers. You know what I mean?
Okay, yes. I was
kind of confused. And so, like, Stilgar, I'm like, yeah, he's funny. Thoughts. He doesn't know that it's been planted, you know, hundreds of years prior. But as the movie goes on, you're like, well, maybe Stilgar is still right because of all the stuff that happens in the movie.
Yeah, it feels like they created an accidental true gospel, like the Bene Gesserit. Yeah. And I guess that's the whole point of, like, part three coming out is this dude actually Messiah, or is this going to unfold in a terrible way? Which is, I'm hoping that's not the case. It's like, you want the religion to be true.
Yeah.
And I know Brett's, like, kind of hiding something right now, and it makes me hurt, because that's the question I have reading the book is, because I remember Mike's book review, he talked about how he's supposed to be this messianic figure, but the way that things unravel, he doesn't spoil it, but he's like, it doesn't turn out the way you think it's going to turn out, which makes me very sad, I think.
Yeah. Similarly, like, it was literally on my computer at work, and it just, like, I was scrolling by something, and it was a small little statement.
Oh, do not, like, ruin this for me.
I won't say a thing. And it didn't really spoil anything, but it was something kind of along the same lines of, like, you know, this isn't exactly what it seems necessarily. So, but that, like, I saw that today. So when I stick by with what I said of, I mean, I think Paul Atreides could go down a dark path.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, if he can see the future, and it seems like he's becoming less and less of himself, and I'm assuming that's what's going to happen in the third one, that he's going to be this cruel, calculated, bad dude by the end of it, and you're going to want him dead because he's going to start doing wild stuff.
No.
Like
no.
A Darth Vader, just dude, like Darth Vader and Anakin. Like, it just seems like they just stole it right out of Star Wars.
Yeah, for those listening, we have visual contact with Brett Branson right now, and his, I don't know what you'd call this face, but it's making me uncomfortable.
Look, I've read the books, clearly, so I'm trying not to, like, give any spoilers. I'm trying to just talk about the movie. He's made some changes in this movie that makes me think, like, he might change the books going forward, which, you know, is, like, something that makes me excited to see what he has planned. But he's never, like, taken away from the spirit of those original two books, so I don't think he will for the third book either, but there's still changes that he can make that'll change how that final episode or, like, final movie would be perceived. I will say, like, in this movie, I think the idea is that you start seeing him go down a darker path. And I think when he drinks the worm vomit,
bro,
that's the change. In the book, it's definitely the change. And here, like, Chani sees him. She doesn't want to wake him up because she knows he has made this decision that will change him into another person. And his promise to her was that he would never do that. You know, like, as long as you stay Paul, I will follow you. But he drinks the spice, and that changes him from Paul into the actual Messiah figure. Yeah. And I think the movie should have done a better job of hammering that home, because that's what he's trying to do, is like, hey, this is the point of no return. He's getting the powers, but it's not like a glorious thing. It's like
he doesn't want it.
He doesn't want it. Like, it's tragic because he's done everything he can to fight this. He doesn't want to go north.
Yeah, and
he doesn't want to do that because he can see the future.
That's kind of why I like that it doesn't point it in that direction more.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, you know, whenever they made the first one, he came out and said, I'm not even going to try to say his name. He came out and said that he, you know, wasn't sure if we were going to get the budget for the second one. And similarly, kind of the same thing happened, and now it's been confirmed that it's going to be made. He wants to make one and all that. But, like, he made the second movie in a way that it could technically end with, you know, this is it. And something I read today, part of that little thing, this is not a spoiler, that the Anya Taylor-Joy character, that scene was basically put, you know, with 45 minutes left in the movie, but essentially that was an end credit scene. But the reason they didn't do it end credits, because that would tease a third movie. So instead, they put it right in the middle. So it doesn't feel like an end credit scene, but it still teases what's to come. So So I was like, it makes
so I guess the next movie is going to jump into the future to where
if he follows the books.
Okay. That's so very depressed. Sad. That's so sad because what that means to me, because, you know, I've never rooted. I mean, you typically there's some type of strand of love story in these movies. Like even in Lord of the Rings with Aragorn and his lady, I didn't care about it. But in this one, I care so much. Yes. I'm like, why am I rooting so hard for Chani in this movie? And so to think that it's about to jump 15 years in the future and they're going to have been relationally separated for that amount of time makes me sick.
Babe, just read the book, bro, because I have so much to say about that.
So,
okay. Oh, it kills me.
Okay, so I think Will, I kind of like how he didn't hammer it home as much, and the way you interpret it is from the looks he gives Zendaya's character Chani or whatever. Oh, like yeah, when he would like the nonverbal acting or whatever, when they just look at each other throughout the whole movie. I'm buying whatever they're selling.
Their chemistry is good.
They're in love in real life. Straight up.
I can tell at the end in the fight scene.
I haven't felt that on-screen love since Jim and Pam, straight up.
The fight scene, he looks at her, and that's for me, that's where it was like, he's going to be this bad guy. He knows it. She knows it. It's too late. Tragedy, kind of. But it's all just through looking. And I was like, frick me. And then that fight was much more meaningful.
I don't think he's going bad there, though. He tells her right before the fight, like, no matter what you watch right now, like, no matter what you perceive, you know that I love you through everything that I'm about to do.
Yeah.
So his heart is still Paul Atreides.
I don't think it is.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
No, you shut up.
I think it is. Like, I think he was serious, you know, when he says, I love you till my last breath or whatever the line is that was, that's an iconic line. Like, I think it very much is like, that's true, but he also knows what he's about to do. And he knows that it's not, like, they are not a possibility at this point.
I'm going to assume that she's going to get written out somehow. Because I don't know the books, I have no idea. But because she just looks off into the sunset, it's like, when's he going to come back for her? If he's going off to fight the freaking multiverse, whatever the heck's up there, like, what's she going to do? She's going to be chilling with the sand people. Like,
listen, just based on Brett's faces right now,
I should have
dropped the book I'm reading.
I should have made y'all read the book so that we could have
Red Rising.
I won't, but
man, so I will say this is their chemistry was awesome the whole movie, and I love what Villeneuve has decided to do with her character. It's different than the book, so that's all I'm gonna say.
That's fine.
Gives you incentive to read, I guess. So that's good. Well, let's move on from her real quick.
If it's going to go down that way, then Princess Irulan better be five times what Chani was for me to enjoy that character and that relationship.
Ain't no way.
Go to the next freaking topic before I get
started. Yeah, okay. Well, let's say, so in the book, Jessica, his mom, and Chani have a relationship. In this movie, there really isn't one. But Jessica is also changed from the book. And in this movie, she might be my favorite character because she's so – like originally it was Paul. And he's like, hey, we've got to convince them that I'm the Messiah. And then she drinks the stuff. And then she's like, oh, no, I am going to convince them that you're the Messiah. And Paul starts fighting that because he's starting to see the future. And she is like all the way on the other side. And it's like this primal fear of like your parent is the one you can't trust anymore. You know, it's like they are pushing you. She's pushing him to this place he doesn't want to be. And I love that. And I love how weird it is with his sister inside of him whispering to her all the time. She almost feels like an omniscient presence in her belly. Just telling him all these things like, hey, this is what, you know, do this. And they're like one person now. It's really creepy and effective. Like my mom said, I don't remember Dune feeling so like evil. And I'm like, yeah, she is like, feels like an evil presence in this movie.
She does feel evil.
Yeah. Yeah. In the greatest way.
A couple hours into the book, I could tell like that difference that you're talking about. The mother feels in the book, very like protective, cautious, and afraid for her son. And in the movie, she's just like the guns are out. She's blazing. She's trying to make everything happen.
She, I think in that first movie, though, I think she is protective and loving of him and is scared for him when she when he's doing the test with the Bene Gesserit, just kind of like the book. I think both of the – I like both of the character development in this. I think she goes more evil, especially when she drinks the – I think both of them, the point of no return is when they can see the future.
Yeah, I did not perceive it that way in the first movie. I felt like she was more concerned with her choice to have a son than she was with the idea of Paul being in danger. It seemed more like she was wanting this role of having the Cusack Hatterack or whatever his name is, that whenever she's facing the Reverend Mother, that that fear is not for Paul, but for herself.
Yeah. So for Jessica's character, what's her name? Jessica.
Yeah. Jessica.
The first movie, I feel like they're just running and hiding. I never got the whole belief thing. I feel like she was just kind of doing it because she was told to. And then at some point, probably when she drank the blue stuff, that she went from like doing it because she's told to like a like real believer and pushing the thing forward instead of doing it out of like fear of death or like something happening to her son. It's like now she just wants to push the belief forward, not from fear of death or survival, but like because she actually believes in it because she can see the future and stuff.
Man, I just want to watch it again right now.
Yeah, I saw the notification come up on my screen from Bryce. Just having watched it again, he said, oh yeah, it's a 10. For sure.
Nice.
I just saw it again. It's a
golly, that's just crazy. I think it's not.
Yeah, Emily and I are going to go see it soon, and I'm so curious to like how she's going to take in a movie like this, because Lord of the Rings was like a stretch as far as getting into a different world like that, and Dune just takes it to another weird level.
Yeah, I don't have much hope that Riley would like this movie.
I don't know how y'all feel about this take, but I wrote it down when we were talking about Jessica's character. The fight scene at the end, I know, like, I feel like everything kind of comes back to that. That's another, like, pivotal moment in, like, the book series or, I guess, in the movie series. But I went from, like, Jessica and Paul being, like, on the same team, like, surviving in the first one. And then the second one, he's resistant to her. And then now he's, like, fearing her. So I feel like when they're fighting, he knows what he has to do, but he's still like in a den of vipers. Like they're all bad guys surrounding him. They're all going to do negative, bad things. And he's just the victim in a sense. But at the same time, he's also going to be like bad dude who's conquering everything. And he's going to use these people around him. It's just like so many mixed emotions and mixed situations that I didn't feel like she was a good guy anymore when he was fighting. Like she was waiting for him to win so she could accomplish whatever goal she wants at his expense.
When politics in a book or a movie are displayed that well to make you like not be able to know who's evil, who's good, who has like the righteous plan kind of insight, that's, oh man, it's hard to beat that type of writing or dramatics in a movie. The same thing with The King on Timothée Chalamet's performance on the Netflix movie. I was like, man, it blew me away with the politics. And when it's done wrong, it's super boring. But when it's done right, it is like, man, the plot feels so rich and like has so much depth.
Yeah. Like during that fight scene, they're surrounded by different, you know, characters or different families, or like the Emperor and his mom and Zendaya's character, Chani, and the other houses are coming in. But it's like, who's in the right at this point? Who is? And that's the beautiful part of this movie, because you can talk about it and you could have an argument for each side of like, well, I see why he's doing that, or how dare him.
Like, yeah,
the way Zendaya's looking at you don't turn that down.
How did y'all feel about the like House Harkonnen reveal, like he's like she's his daughter or whatever?
Yeah, y'all never read the books. How did that hit y'all?
I as long as he stayed true to being Paul Atreides, like being Duke of Atreides, I didn't care. Go kill everybody.
I think, if that scene had happened in a movie that was like a 7, it would have hit harder. But because every scene hit at a 10, the scene was like, oh wow, yeah, that's cool. But like, it was cool. Like, I liked the additional depth.
Yeah,
but I don't know how much it necessarily added.
I think it proves that they're still doing the breeding. Like, he is actually the guy they wanted on the seat, you know, because they're doing the breeding to get the Cusack Hatterack for them.
Yeah.
And then he's there and he's not who they want him to be. They want to be able to control him. And that's why they pivot to Fade Rotha. And like, he obviously is not going to be exactly what they want, but Paul is like not controllable anymore, you know? And that's cool to me. Cause like, I think that when that twist happens, you're like, okay, that makes sense. Like to them, this guy was going to be this Messiah figure that they've created. And so to me, I think that's like, I was like, that is a cool way to incorporate that. And then it also kind of just goes back to like, who's good, who's bad. You know, they've been taught that the Harkonnens are just this evil group of people, but it turns out they are Harkonnen. You know, it's like, okay, well, they are doing some pretty evil, pretty shady stuff. I don't know. It's pretty cool. And then, okay, well, what do you think, Gabe?
Well, I'm just, they're Harkonnen by blood, but by yeah. like, by their moral value system, they are not Harkonnen.
You say that, but for sure, Leto, his dad, was not Harkonnen. His mom is Harkonnen.
Yeah.
And she is not that way. She bad.
Yeah.
And so Paul has the bad in him, and I think that that is intentional by the Bene Gesserit, you know, not for it to be bad, but to have that kind of blood in him.
Yeah.
And I think that his turn is going Harkonnen, you know, and he's using Harkonnen tactics to kill Harkonnens.
Before they decide that he's not the one that they, you know, bred or whatever, was it the plan to unite those two houses under him? Because he's House Harkonnen and he's House Atreides, even though
he would have the Fremen and he would have the whole Emperor.
Yeah.
Like the whole, he would be in charge of everything and they would have him under his thumb.
Yeah. So that was the whole plan, was to unite those two houses. Cause those are the top two houses, right? If I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Besides the Emperor, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that would make sense I never put that together in the movie. Like after thinking about it, it makes sense, but I don't know. Maybe it just didn't hit cause I wasn't like thinking that at the moment.
I'm confused. You're confusing me with this. Yeah, you're saying this is true for the book, but for the movie, this is not true.
Yes, it is, because why else would they put it in there?
Yeah.
No, because they went to Fade Rotha only because they thought that Paul Atreides was dead, not because they wanted to. In the movie, yeah. It's a surprise that Paul Atreides is alive.
Yeah, that part, that's true. Like, there's whispers of him, but they all think it's another.
I'll have to watch it again. Yeah, I'll have to watch it again, but I think that they.
The Bene Gesserit finds out through.
Yeah.
You know, they find out.
Uh-huh.
But. They have to pivot. They still try to pivot to Fade or whatever his name is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What did y'all think about Fade?
I love Austin Butler. He's cool.
Dude, I think he's got a real punchable face. I think that's just, you know, that's his look. I felt that way in Elvis, you know, whatever. But anyways, I thought that his character just was...
He beat you up.
Was I didn't even do that one. His character was, like... vicious, and I thought they did, like, it's really cool to me how they have Dave Bautista, Austin Butler, and Timothée Chalamet, and Bautista's like the biggest dude of the three of them, but he makes Bautista look like a shrimp, and then Timothée Chalamet then makes Austin Butler look like a shrimp. I mean, I guess not, that was a good fight, but like that just goes to show how dominant of an actor Timothée Chalamet is, because I didn't think for one second, like, this scrawny little guy just beat that guy up. Like, no, he just delivered that performance to where I didn't have a doubt in my mind that he was going to win that fight.
There's so much to talk about. You didn't think there was a chance he died? Did any of you guys think there's a chance he died in this movie?
No.
Wait, who? Fade Rotha?
No, sorry. Paul, there at the end. Get you on the where you were like, he might die.
I wondered because I was like, there's still the bloodline of his sister. Like,
uh-huh.
What the heck her role is.
Man, that would have devastated me.
That would have been a great ending because I wouldn't have seen that coming, that's for sure.
That's true.
Yeah.
I did like the way that the Duke, the House Harkonnen lead guy, what's his?
Fade Rotha? Or the Baron.
The Baron, yeah. The way he died was cool. And what did he say to him before he killed him? Like,
you die like an animal. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, dang, that was cool. He just marches up to him like, you can't do nothing, kind of a thing. That was pretty hard.
And I love the callback of like, they're always searching for humans, and he's like, you die like a dog. You're not on my level. You're not
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's what going back all the way to part one with the Reverend Mother, when she says, when people are in pain, they either face it like a human or they run away like an animal. And then for him to go to his greatest nemesis, who took out his dad, and be like, you don't die like my dad. You die like a...
Yeah.
It goes so hard.
It goes so hard.
See it again.
I know.
I don't even know, Brett. I don't know how to do this. Like, you know that thing people do when they're like, ooh, wee, and they kind of snap their fingers. Like,
not a clue. Not a clue. Yeah,
You try to do that in the movie theater.
Exactly. I don't know how to do it, but I felt the need to express physically what I was experiencing. So I tried to do the finger snap like you're popping a tobacco can, and I couldn't do it. But I was like, I have to do something to let out this pent-up dominant energy that's inside of me from watching this dude. And Spencer did it later in the movie. I was like, I'm glad someone can do it right. I was sitting here flipping my wrist around like an idiot. That was one of those scenes that made me feel that way.
Let's go back to Fade Rotha just for a little bit. I love their planet. I love the aesthetics of it. I love that they're under a black sun, so everything looks alien, even though they're humans. It's such a cool idea. And the way it's shot, you almost have the Boba Fett lens, and you're just looking at different points in the crowd, and you're seeing all the things and the whole trick of him like not poisoning the guy and letting him fight for real. I think it builds Fade Rotha's character up too as someone who values honor so much.
Yeah, when I was kind of confused a little bit when he was like, when the Baron was like doing things that Fade didn't know about for his birthday. You know, he was saying it's for his birthday, but I felt like he was either trying to kill him or test him. I don't know what it was.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right.
And then as evil as he is, he valued honor so much that he like, when he killed the guy finally, he was like, you fought well. Like, he gave him respect for fighting, because previously he killed everyone that was, it was rigged. They were all pre-injured or whatever, because the Atreides dudes are really hard fighters, so they were scared to kill Fade. But this last one, I guess they didn't do that. And I thought that was pretty cool of his character to show him respect, even though he's a maniac.
I don't know if I'd use the word honorable to describe his motives.
No, when he killed the guy, killed the guy, he showed like that guy honor by like, you fought well.
Yeah, I guess.
Or respect.
I think he just loves challenge. Not that he feels the need to respect anybody. Because when he turns around and slits that lady's throat next to him, when he gets that.
Yeah, knife, it's a good point. Yeah, not very honorable.
He is not honorable.
Yeah, it's not honorable.
Oh, no. He's psychotic as heck. Yeah.
Yeah. Or, I don't know. Whatever it was. Because he does the same thing to Timothy Chalamet's character at the very
end. Yeah.
Yeah, he admires challenge, right? Because even when he kills his uncle, who he admires so much, he copies his voice. They sound almost identical in this movie. He's like, oh, okay, all right, this guy's real, you know. Yeah, I think also, yeah, it was so trippy.
I figured it out. My brain was just spinning, trying to figure out why are they changing colors in the shadows. I was like, what is going on?
It's so cool though. Who is Dave Bautista's character?
Beast
Harkonnen or something like that.
Yeah. His name's Nephew.
He kind of gets embarrassed. He's trying so hard not to fail, he gets embarrassed. And that scene, the first time I was like, okay, they're starting to show Paul as a bad guy, is when he comes out of the dust with his hood on and makes the guy pee his pants, and he runs back into his ship and he says to retreat.
So that's the scene where Gabe almost jumped out of his seat whenever a Bremen guy rolled across the bottom of the screen and just sliced a guy's ankle.
Yeah.
About to hop out of his seat. I was like, oh.
When he cut that dude and then he rolled into the mist of the sand and disappeared, I was like, this is crazy looking. Because you look at it and you're like, I mean, it felt like ninjas, but in a way that made sense. It wasn't some mystical, like, he cut him and then he disappeared. Where'd he go? Which is how typically that kind of crap happens in movies. Like, even with Batman, you know, he's there and then he's gone. And it's like, oh, what? I'm like, he's Batman, but he's not, you know, the Flash. It don't make any sense. But in this, it's like he cuts him and there's enough time to see the wisp figure of a man.
Right.
But then he disappears into the sand. because of his knowledge of the environment, which they've already impressed on you for the first, you know, two hours of the movie, that it just makes such perfect sense that they're able to disguise themselves in the sand. It's just, oh, it's so beautiful. Like all that setup for little attack moments like that. Mm-hmm. It's just, the payoff is just, it's better than any movie I've experienced.
Yeah.
The music goes hard there too. I know you didn't notice it, Spencer, but the music, I was like, oh, it's giving me life. So cool.
I think Spencer's, you know, lack of musical awareness, I guess, is only preaches to how good it is, because
it's absorbing it into the moment.
He's just straight up plugged into it, that it all sounds like it's supposed to be happening.
All right, we've hit on a lot here. Well, do we want to I've seen some people praising Florence Pugh as Princess Irulan, and I'm like, I don't know what she did. I mean, she was good. Everyone in here was pretty good, except for Christopher Walken. It's not his fault, but I did not think he was a good cast. No, it was weird.
Let me go ahead and shout out John Bird here for having the worst take in possibly Discord history, saying that the star of Dune 2. I mean, the same thing as the book, if I'm right, Brett. She just has this expository role of explaining kind of what's going on. It's like if a narrator came in and was like, and at this moment, Paul was thinking about this. And then it shows Paul like doing something. That's what it feels like watching her. Not that she did bad. She's very dignified looking and everything. But her role is boring.
Yeah.
It's a standout like role. I was like, what are you talking about, John?
I heard that too. That's
good. Yeah, John, you better be listening to this talk.
But she, you know, people are saying she's good. It was good. And I mean, I think I'm excited to see her in the third movie.
Yeah, I'm
going to
take a way better role in the third movie.
Yeah, she'll be great.
How did y'all feel about Gurney Halleck? How do y'all feel about him? Because I thought they might cut him out.
Tell him that scene.
Okay, so he was sick, and I was so mad that they used him the way they did in the first one. And so I knew that he was going to come back just because of I had the spoilers or whatever. But
I didn't know that.
At some point, he was going to probably come back. And anyways, so the scene where they're marching – and he's just going through this hallway, and he's just cutting dudes down, almost at a run. And there's just a dude with a flag, just leading the pack. Just all he did was hold the flag. He didn't fight anyone. No one touched him. Just behind him, just trucking along.
Yeah,
hard. And then the camera's like going along with him, like parallel to him. I was like, this hard. Is so freaking cool.
And I didn't even notice that until Spencer told me, because I'm just watching this dude slash people down. But then when we got out of the movie, and he's like, dude, there's literally a guy just walking behind him with a flag in pure confidence that this dude's about to slaughter anybody who steps in front of him.
Yeah.
Hard.
It reminded me of the Patriot in the very end where they have the flags, you know, and like the flag guys are kind of telling the army which way to go, and they start retreating. So he just grabs the flag and runs forward himself, and then everyone turns around. That's why I felt that's kind of like was
reminiscent. Except for he was on the attack.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's just going straight into it.
His
line whenever he kills the Baron's nephew, and he stabs him in the throat, and he says, "This is for my Duke. This is for my friends." That was the only line that in the moment it caught me in the movie where I was like, "Was that a great line?" I don't really know if that was a great line. And then it kind of felt corny for a second. Like I wanted him to say, "This is for my Duke. This is for my family," as if he's just. He loves the Atreides house so much that he considers them family. But also, the more I thought about it after the movie, there are several points in the movie where he takes his role as protector of House of Atreides so seriously that he totally disregards his own emotions and feelings. And like when Paul's like, and that's an order. And he's immediately like, yes, Duke. Like, I get it. So in the end, when he says, my friends, I feel like he's putting himself in a category less.
I thought that was a consistent thing for his character too.
Exactly. So it's like in the movie, it caught me, but after the movie, I was like, no, that was an absolutely beautiful line.
If you had said just for my Duke, I'd have been great with that.
Yeah, me too.
I thought he delivered it well too. The way he delivered it, I felt it. Like he's a great, everyone is great actors in this. It's awesome, except for Christopher Walken. So it's really cool.
Why? What's the problem with that? I mean,
I can only see him. Like, you have that problem with Tom Cruise. He looks like Christopher Walken in the Dune universe. You know, I'm like, what is he? He's like, everyone has like an impression of him. And I don't know, he just looks old and decrepit and out of place to me. And so it's not even his fault, really. Like, he wasn't terrible. But in my head, when I've read the books, I have someone there with some kind of presence, but he just looks, it looked like he'd blow on him and he'd fall over. And I'm like, this is the leader of the entire known galaxy. And he's like, he's barely got a presence there. And he like, the wall blows up next to him and he like shakes like that. I'm like, you look like a little punk.
Well, dude, he's the emperor. He doesn't face danger. He's sitting up right there. The most dominant figure in this movie has the shape of Will Dixon. Okay, so I think you're being a little unfair to this guy.
Also, why is he so old? Why is he so old? His daughter is not that old. He doesn't have to be that old. Give him some presence to him. Like, I can think of a bunch of actors I'd rather have there. And like, again, not really his fault. I think he's just miscast. So that was the only thing that took me out of the movie every single time I saw him.
I thought about that because, you know, when I watched him, I don't know. I feel like I've never seen. I feel like I know his face and I've seen him 1,000 times, but I can't even tell you what movie he's in. But I thought he did a great job. But after you said you had a problem with him, I was like, if I had to cast like this dark, ominous, powerful, present emperor, you know who I think would have been awesome to see as a surprise cast?
Idris Elba.
Walter White.
I almost said him.
He would have been like an epic. Like, to see his face come up as, like, the evil emperor, oh, that would...
I was thinking someone like Mads Mikkelsen. I thought he'd have been a good choice, too. Like, he's the right age, and he has a good presence, but, you know, it's just... Everything else is so great, it doesn't really matter that much, but I will just say that was my one gripe about the whole movie, I think.
Yeah, I wish... Yeah. If I'm going, like, critiques, there's, like, a couple minor things. Like, the fight with Gurney and where he kills the Duke's nephew or whatever. I wish that fight was a little more impactful. I feel like he killed him too easy, you know?
Well, I think it's just to show how much of a BA he is. Like, he's not going to – like, he's on a much higher level than this guy who was kind of a win.
And I thought that was interesting that in the first movie they made him seem like a really scary guy, and this one he actually wasn't. He's kind of like a fraud in a lot of ways. And then the thing that I've heard going viral, like the memes and stuff, was them getting on and off the worms – in the giant group of people. It's like, how did they manage to get 600 people on a worm? Like,
they're going to show that on part 3.
Are they?
Yes. Dennis said that he said he had a vision for how they do it. And he thought about putting it in the second one, but he said the flow of the second movie was so good. He didn't want to interrupt it in a way that felt like he was trying to explain something. So he said he has a natural way of explaining it in the third movie.
It's not in the books either.
No. Not that I know of. That's another thing about the movie that I like more than the books is the books, they don't go into the action very much at all. They almost skip it entirely. And in the movies, like, you see it, and it feels visceral and real. And I also love how at that final scene, like that final battle, it feels like an absolute slaughter. Like, he drops the bombs on them, and they go in there and they wipe them out. And it feels like a parallel to the first time when the Harkonnens come in and do that to them. And so, like, that contrast there is great. And Paul coming in, I thought it was funny too, because he was like leagues in front of his army. It's almost like he said, "Hey guys, I want to walk real cool all by myself in the front. You guys come in after me." But it did look cool. It worked for me. But yeah, I thought that was an awesome battle.
So they nuked the mountain so the worms could get through that little passageway. Is that what I was understanding?
In the movie, I think so. In the books, I think they just literally nuked the shields so that the shields would go down.
That whole scene's crazy. They just come from.
It looks so good. It looks so good.
It's so long. It's like, how long is this? Like, is it going to show this vast fight scene? Because it feels expensive, but it just keeps going and going and going. And I'm like, golly, it looks beautiful.
I'm telling you, anytime they get out of the sand to fight and they pop up out of the sand, every time I just get chills. Like, that's one of the coolest things in history.
Because you see him coming from way behind and you're like, okay, we've got to wait another 10 seconds before we see any sort of, you know, them getting to each other. And then, nope, someone just popped out of the sand right then and there and slices them up.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Spoiler real quick. Spencer, I deleted the when I put silence in the Discord, and you're like, no, you gotta get rid of that. I was like, dude, he's right, because I did not see that in the trailer, like going into the movie. And had I, because I was waiting for him to use the voice in the movie.
Yeah, same.
And also, can I just say how beautifully the voice is spared in the movie? Like they use it only in moments that you don't expect. It's never like when you watch Star Wars, it's like, dude, just use the Force to get out of the situation. In Dune, it's like I forget about it almost, and then they use it, and I'm like, oh, that was powerful. Like, it just hit so hard.
When he yells at the Bene Gesserit, ugh.
Yeah, when he screams silence, and she's like, abomination. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I almost squealed to that part. Like, I wanted to freaking – that part was so good. But yeah, had I seen that in the trailer, I would have totally been like, oh, he's about to say it. He's about to say it. And it would have took away from it so hard. So I'm glad I did not see that. I'm done. Like, I've never been one to really stay away from trailers, but seeing how much every scene took me by surprise in this movie, I'm definitely doing that going forward.
It matters, because, like, even the movie creator, the one with, like, the AI robots or whatever, I refuse to watch any trailers for that, and I know how trailers are nowadays. They give you the entire plot, and so, like, you're expecting scenes to come because you know, okay, generally this is going to happen in the third act. You're just waiting for that third act instead of just taking it in as it comes. And it makes a big difference, because those two movies are very high on my list.
I felt like the only scene I saw prior to going to see Dune 2 was I saw the giant worm going and dropping into the sand. And I had no idea when that part of the movie was going to be, because there's so much desert that it could be any moment. And so, it was amazing. Not knowing what was next, I loved it.
Yeah, I didn't watch a single trailer the entire time. So I mean, I just knew that I was going to like it because I liked the first one. Yeah. And that's about all I had going in.
Yeah, when Dune Messiah starts rolling out and people start posting stuff, I'm going to be reporting so many pages. I'm going to be reporting them for sexual nudity, like whatever I can get them the most in trouble for. Like, oh, they're harassing me. Oh, they're putting up provocative images. I'm trying to get them canceled. Yeah. I'm not dealing with that.
My rule for trailers now is if I'm going to see a movie, I'm not watching the trailer. If I don't know, that's when I watch a trailer. When I'm like, I need to be convinced to watch this, that's when I'll watch it. I
just think that, like, a teaser trailer. I'll watch a teaser trailer for something, and that's it. Like, just a little 15-second, here's just the world you're about to get into. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's all I need.
Agreed. That's all they should be.
Yeah. With some, like, maybe some music to show the tone of the movie. Like a dark tone, a light tone. That's all I need.
Talk about also, we were just saying, like, dialogue that we liked. How did y'all feel about when Stilgar asks, at the very end, Stilgar asks Paul, he's like, what do we do now? And he said, lead him to paradise. I loved that. That was so cool. And it's like so... it's such a, like, a... He says it with sorrow, because he knows what's about to happen.
And,
oh, I love it.
So this is just more stuff about the third movie I thought Dune 1 and 2 is just book 1, and Dune
it is
the second book, and then there's a third book.
There's like I don't know how many, like 9 maybe.
I thought there was like just an original trilogy though, if I'm not mistaken.
I think Herbert writes the first 5 and then his son picks it up and writes some after that.
I thought there was only 3 books.
Yeah.
See, I heard there's a lot. Dune Messiah, like, it was really only planned to be a book, but then the author was like, wait, y'all are taking this the wrong way.
Yep.
And wrote Dune Messiah.
Yep. And then it made money and stuff, and so he just kept writing it because he had more ideas.
Okay.
But originally he was only going to write one book, and then people were taking it the wrong way that he didn't intend for it to take, so then he writes another book. He writes another book, and so
to get the message across,
and then after that they keep making more. But
so do you think they're gonna make Dune Messiah and that's gonna be a good cutoff, or are they gonna try to do
I think it'll be a great cutoff, and I'm excited to see how he chooses to do it,
because I heard
that. I really want to know.
The harder, the more
confusing,
the more
ridiculous they get. I'm gonna be honest with you, I didn't like Messiah that much, and I tried to read Children of Dune and I was like, I'm done. I'm not here for it.
So that's what I was a little worried about, if they try to prolong it. But I don't think Denis, whatever the heck his name is, the director, would, like, go that far, because he knows quality versus quantity kind of
thing.
He's not going to produce them to make money. He's
gonna- and he said, and he said himself, like, I'm only going to make these three movies.
Okay.
Good. Yeah. So good.
I respect that.
Not only that, but with how Marvel's doing right now, I feel like that's sending the message across to all great directors. Like, there's a, you have to know a cutting point.
Yeah, it should have ended after Endgame or the Spider-Man one, whatever the Spider-Man.
Spider-Man No Way Home.
No Way Home, yeah.
Anything else I'm doing y'all want to say before we outro?
Yeah.
I'm going to think of like seven things.
One last thing. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by shankitgolf.com. Use the promo code Willie D for 15% off. It's WILLIEDEE.
That's all. Hey, dude, it's a real thing. Thank you, Golf.
That's not a bit.
It's not a bit. All right. Anything you want to plug, Spencer or Gabe?
I got nothing, bro.
No. Anything you want to say about Doom?
I'm having to rethink my entire rating list because my next movie is a 9.6, and it's way better than 0.3 points better than that movie. So
yeah, that's my last thing too, is that I do think Dune Part 2 is the greatest movie ever made, and I'm not exaggerating. I literally have to say that. And when I tell my, like, when I got home to my wife, I was like, listen to what I'm about to say and know that I'm being 100% wholehearted right now.
It's like
that's the greatest movie that has ever been made. And she's like, you don't mean that. And I was like, did you hear what I just prefaced with? I'm being so serious. It's the greatest movie that's ever been made. So for the millions that are listening, I'm not kidding. It's the greatest movie ever made.
Yeah. I keep responding to everyone's ratings with like, that's crazy. But like, I'm not saying it's crazy high. I'm saying it's crazy that that is accurate.
Yeah.
It is insane. At least amongst our group, like 9.6, I think is the lowest rating I've heard. And that's from me. And that's still a 9.6. So
before you close it out, I did have one more thing. We skipped the whole scene where he's in the South with all the fundamentalists and that meeting where there's like tens of thousands, if not 100,000 people in this freaking room. And he starts just like challenging them. And they like tells these dudes like secrets or like these things that he shouldn't know about them. And everyone's like, oh, frick. And they start like freaking out, you know? And
like
they start
straight up Messiah mode.
Dude, yeah.
Straight up woman up the well.
That was great.
Exactly. Who in here can stand against me? So freaking good.
I love too when he walks out of that and the shot of the like drone shot of all the bodies and everyone's just walking past, like he's walking in the middle of them. They're all clearing a path for him and like wanting to touch his like robe and stuff. And it's just like, it's so epic. It's so epic. And he's like full, like he's a Haderach right there, whatever, how you say it. He's just like full on, I am the chosen one. Let's go conquer the universe. Like, I got a plan. And it just, and the music swelling, it is so good. I'm glad you brought that up. That's
a good scene. The I want the director of Dune to make some Bible stories, dude. Because if he just makes this Messiah kind of story, some Old Testament stories, he would go, it'd be so good.
He'd listen, this might be sacrilegious, but it wouldn't be as good as Dune.
I don't know. You can do some pretty, you can have some pretty epic moments. If you did like the life of David, I think that's the only thing that could touch it cinematically is David's life.
Yeah.
The Goliath takedown, the sending people to war on his behalf, getting them killed so he can be with their wife, all that crazy stuff.
Yeah.
That movie could go pretty hard.
That's true.
Send him an email.
I cannot wait for y'all to get this next movie so I can. Oh man, Herbert, I think it'd be rolling in his grave to hear y'all comparing this to the Bible.
Listen, I mean, I'm gonna be talking to you when I finish the books. I don't care to read everything, Brett, but I'm gonna read Dune and then Dune Messiah.
Okay, that's all I've read.
I'll do a solo podcast with you if you want over books 1 and 2.
Let's do it.
I'm so conflicted with Messiah.
I can't.
Just based off of Brett's facial reactions.
Let me tell you, if I could go back, I would not read Messiah. So, Gabe, honestly, I think you should just do it with the movie, and then go back and read the book.
He wants to be heartbroken before.
I'm telling you, the movie is better.
I can appreciate heartbreak. So.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe you'll like Messiah. Maybe you'll eat it up.
Yeah.
I'll be interested. Like
chapter.
It's not like that though, because I don't think it's a very good. It doesn't matter. It's the end of the podcast, I think. All right, guys. Thanks for coming on. I enjoyed it. Everyone listening, I appreciate you listening this long. I hope you liked the movie as much as we did. Thanks, like and subscribe, all the things. Later.